us are on the way, and a pickup up my sleeve. They call my team insane, say I'm the one to beat. So you better bring your A game and start playing, cause every single week another win for me.
Yo, commissioner, you can just pay me now. City win first place, then take a bow. Finish on top, I'ma set the standard. Don't believe me, you could check the standings. When I draft, I make smart selections. Got more sleepers than a narcoleptic. Meet your match, kid, my lineup's nasty. It's far-fetched, thinking you might catch me. No surprise, I'm taking home the prize. Only time I rest.
Welcome to another edition of the Great Fantasy Baseball Invitational Podcast, the Beat the Shift edition. I am your host for today, Ariel Cohen. We are giving Justin Mason the night off once again. And with us, as always, is Ruvane Guy. Ruvane, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great as well. With us today, we have a special treat here. All the way from Hawaii, he is the 2018 FSWA Baseball Writer of the Year. He works at Rotographs and going to be writing for CBS Sportsline, Alex Chamberlain. Welcome to the show, Alex.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
So what's going on with you lately?
Nothing. Just talking about, you know, mundane, really heady fantasy baseball stuff on Twitter. just, you know, procrastinating on actually preparing for the season. So just the usual stuff.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Last time that we had the show, it was actually a beautiful day in New York. It was 60 degrees here in February, and today we've got snowstorms. We've got snow and ice. Ruvane, how is it by you up there?
It's quite cold, quite icy. Spending an hour shoving the drive is not fun, but it is fun knowing that pitchers and catchers reported yesterday and today. That makes me think warm.
Yeah, we've got pitchers and catchers day today. That's definitely the first step towards baseball. Not that this offseason has really been very fast, but we're about ready to go. And Machado and Harper, when will they sign? Probably never, right?
It's not just Machado and Harper. There's also Kimbrel out there, Dallas Keuchel. There's a whole bunch of free agents that will be affected by not signing at this time already.
All right, so we're going to start with our strategy section today, and we're going to talk a little bit more about drafting. And to introduce a concept, Alex, can you tell us about what Kentucky Derby style drafting is?
Kentucky Derby style drafting is for snake drafts, and you basically, like, depending on the size of the league, 10 teams, 12 teams, 15 teams, you get to rank in order which slot you would prefer to draft out of. So the default would be, you know, you prefer one, and then next off you'd prefer two, then three, then four, all the way down to 10 or 12 or 15, what have you. The KDS style, which they use for the National Fantasy Baseball Championship and perhaps other formats, I'm not sure. You get to choose. You get to rank them and kind of order your preference, and then I guess an algorithm, the computer, optimizes everyone's preferences and determines a final draft order. So if you don't want to draft first, if you want to draft fourth or fifth or sixth because you perceive that as being most valuable, you can prefer that over the default rank.
All right. So what is your preference this year, Alex? When you're setting the your KDS, what are you doing this year?
This is something that I really only started doing last year in my first foray into NFBC. I'm inclined to kind of throw, especially, so like, for example, in a 12-team league, I'm inclined to throw picks 5 through 8 to the top, followed by 1, 2, 3, 4, and then finish off with 9, 10, 11, 12. I'm really, really reluctant to get like the last two picks in any draft. I hate drafting at the turn. If I get the first or second pick, I can live with that. I'm not going to complain, but you know, if I get 14th or 15th, it's going to be kind of upsetting. I think there's a lot of interchangeability at the top of drafts. And the sooner you can pick in the second round, the better off you'll be. So I think there's an argument to be made to draft out of the middle instead of like maybe at the top, and then grabbing a mid second round pick rather than waiting till the end of the second round to get your guy. But everyone has their own preference. I'm looking to get like maybe the number five pick because I'm thinking about like Scherzer or Cunha, but I'm not really sold on a position yet for this year. I haven't finalized my picks for the TGFBI yet.
Right, yes, and TGFBI is a league that is following the NFBC format this year, so there is going to be a KDS Kentucky Derby-style drafting. Do you think that there's a difference year-to-year? Like, you know, this year, based on the players, would you pick a different KDS than last year?
Yeah, definitely. So, like, I think, like, last year I was actually gunning for the late first round. I'm trying to think what it was last year. It was like, you know, like Betts or like Trout, Betts, Altuve at the top. I think Kershaw was fourth or fifth, and it was like Scherzer going around eighth, and I was really liking his value there. So I was doing a lot of like pick 7, 8, 9, last year. And now this year I'm doing like, you know, 4, 5, 6 with the idea that I might get Scherzer or, I'm not like totally sold on getting Acuña as my rock, but you know, like a power speed guy at the beginning, like a Trey Turner type. So, the jury's still out, but yeah, definitely. It definitely depends on the ADP each year. I think you can't just go in blindly. I think you really have to think critically about like how you envision your snake draft, kind of playing out and craft your strategy that way.
Right. Yeah, no, I agree that, I mean, personally, I would always, as a default, choose 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 down to 15 because, you know, not just the first two rounds, you're going to be picking first and have the most value every single odd round, you know, all the way down. And you always want to pick earlier to get the most value. It's just sort of a small unfair advantage. The only difference I would say is if you happen to find a very big discrepancy between your values and ADP, especially in the first four rounds, then you might want to adjust that. But I'm personally right now going one straight to 15. Ruvane, what are you doing this year for Kentucky Derby style?
My preference is actually very similar to Alex's. I actually like the 4, 5, 6 slot only because 1 and 2, we know we're going 1 and 2. With Lindor's injury, there's no guarantee who's going to be number 3. Is Scherzer going to move up to 3? I doubt it. Do I want Scherzer at 4? Not really, which is why I prefer maybe a 5 pick. But if I'm at 4, I'm still going after Scherzer. Because after that, after the first couple of pitchers, there's a huge drop down. And if you don't get one of those top pitchers, you're going to be in trouble and you're going to be scrambling and you're going to be grabbing early.
Okay. So I wanted to talk a little bit about a piece that I just wrote for Fangraphs today, which is the case for an ace. But basically, I'm suggesting to everybody that the best way to allocate pitching spend in an auction or in a draft, you know, where to buy your pitchers, I'm thinking that the best thing to do is to buy an ace. And I gave a bunch of historical arguments here that showed that the return on investment is best for the elite pitchers and is best all the way low down at the $1, $2 pitchers so that, you know, you're best going stars and scrubs for pitching and not doing a spread the risk thing. Like, it's very important to grab that ace. And that spurned a little bit of a Twitter conversation this evening. Alex, any thoughts on whether it's better to grab an ace early or really doesn't matter, you know, where you get your pitching as long as you get good value?
Well, I think there's a couple of kind of facets to it. I you already know that I agree with what you think based on my own research, which is it aligns really well with yours. In terms of like a snake draft, I'm always inclined to anchor my staff with two aces. In past years, I've tried to, you know, I've maybe arrogantly perceived myself as identifying pitching talent. Everyone's getting better at doing that, and also everyone's paying more for pitchers. So you really have to kind of pick your spots. And, you know, I'm kind of at a point where I'm avoiding the big minefield in the mid rounds of the pitching, you know, like Paul Sporer calls it the glob. I just call it the minefield because glob. It seems like the minefield is it's a terrifying place to try to build a rotation because there's so much bust potential, as you showed in your post. So I've been doing a lot of 2 ace 4 scrub rotations, and you know, beyond the fact that that your profitability improves, or maybe doesn't improve, but at least isn't declining in the late rounds, there's much lower risk, and your pitchers are much more easily replaceable, which is another thing that's kind of overlooked. We're talking about profitability in the draft, but so many guys bust, get injured, whatever. The kind of the mental obstacle of having to cut bait with a guy that you drafted can be really difficult if you paid a lot of money for him. You get your 2 aces and your 4 scrubs. Those scrubs suck. You can just cut bait and use fab to get someone else. So there's not only like a draft profitability aspect, but also a like in-season flexibility aspect. So I'm always like, you know, I'm stars and scrubs in auction, but especially for pitchers, like I find myself doing exactly what you described in your post.
Right. So, you know, let's say you're picking 7th in a draft and Scherzer's off the board number 5. At 7, are you foregoing some of the better values in hitting some of those big superstars, or are you picking either a Sale or a DeGrom number 7?
Not going to be DeGrom. Sale, maybe. I'm okay with getting someone in the second round. Like, I'm totally okay with anchoring my staff with Kluber. I'm even okay anchoring my staff with Carrasco, who's like SP12 right now. So you know, it's not like I have to get like an absolute number one top tier guy. But if I'm not getting a Scherzer Sale kind of thing, like if I go Carrasco third round, I'm going to want, you know, Kluber second round, or I guess maybe Syndergaard might be a second round guy. So I definitely want to get, I'm thinking very critically here about getting 2 starters in those first 3 rounds a lot of the time. If not, no later than the 4th round, I better have 2 starters on my team, and 2 guys that I really trust, not just, you know, picking a guy just to make it fit my strategy. If it doesn't pan out that way, it doesn't pan out, but I'm not going to force like Noah Syndergaard and Walker Buehler on my roster when I'm not fully confident that I trust them to anchor my roster for the full season.
Right.
But what if that strategy doesn't work? I mean, you're getting two pitchers out of the first 3 rounds. Won't that hamper your offense? I mean, you're not going to get those stat getters. You're not concerned about that?
No, I'm not concerned about that. And I think there's a lot. So I think there's an interesting kind of dynamic in that. And I didn't mean to interrupt you. I apologize. I think there's an interesting dynamic with pricing, and Ariel kind of pointed to this in his post, is that like a long time ago, pitchers would never exceed $30 in auction, or I guess an ADP like auction equivalent dollars. Now you can get guys who are $40. So the dynamic has completely changed, and the aggressiveness for pitching has inherently kind of just put a damper on the hitting market in general. Like the something has got to give. Like if you're allocating more of your draft stock to pitching early, then there are hitters who are inevitably going to fall through the cracks. And I could probably rattle off like a dozen names of hitters who I think are going to be really underrated and are still underrated per ADP. I have many targets. In fact, so many, you know, throughout the first 6-8 rounds or whatever, that I feel like I could safely get, you know, my 2 pitchers and then not have to worry about not only getting a big bat or, you know, a base stealer, whatever, but one of your big boppers, but not only getting one of those, but finding guys who will generate profit on those picks too, not just like break even, but like actually be very profitable because they're so misvalued.
Right.
So that's really seeing it a lot in 2019 more so than in previous years, I think.
Yeah, there's a bigger chance of turning a profit on the middle round hitters than the pitchers. The pitchers is so dreary in the middle that you need to really bank up top and low. And by the way, if you guys haven't read this piece, please do so. It's on Fangraphs on the Rotographs section. It's called The Case for an Ace. Just wanted to finish off the strategy section with a little bit more risk here. Alex, can you compare what you think the risk is of Max Scherzer versus Jacob deGrom versus Chris Sale? And there's always risk for pitchers getting injured, but you know, some of those pitchers might be a little bit older, some Sale coming off of what could be an injury or fatigued arm. How would you rank the risk of those pitchers returning close to first round value?
I would have to look at DeGrom's page again because I haven't really done like a deep dive on him. I think Sale would probably be the riskiest. He's just had, you know, I guess maybe the diciest injury history of the three. Scherzer has been an absolute workhorse, but he's entering like his age 35 season. So that carries its own risk. And DeGrom, I mean, I'm a little puzzled just because I think there's a lot of sharp people doing high stakes fantasy who are chasing ERA right now. And not that DeGrom's not good, but there's definitely like an implicit bias that people aren't realizing that they're in the same way that people are chasing Edwin Diaz's 57 saves or whatever. They're not, you know, I think they might be overpricing DeGrom a bit. So his risk would be maybe performance related. So I guess I would go Scherzer, DeGrom, Sale, but I'm not hugely concerned about any of the three.
Right. Funny that I put a Twitter poll out today and I asked who considers Sale a top three pitcher. 35% of the people actually said he's not in the top three, which is interesting. But you know, hey, that's people here. All right. So now let's get into our player discussion here. We're on our part two of outfielders. And what we do here, Alex, since this is your first time on the show here, we throw up a couple of players who the ATC projection system, as compared to what the ADP is, show as a bargain. And the way I like to operate looking at players is I run the ATC projections and it bubbles up to the top who is an undervalued player, and then you know we dive in to see whether we really buy that or not, and it goes on our list of guys who we can purchase. So first on our list is Max Kepler. Max Kepler, I'm projecting for an $11 player, and he's going for an auction equivalent of about $3. He scored 80 runs last year, so I think he's a great run production guy. His batting average was low last year, but somewhat fluky. I think his homer to fly ball rate was also very fluky. If you look at his homer to fly ball rate and some of his fly ball numbers, I think that Max Kepler could bounce back at least to 25 and possibly even to 30, and can be a fantastic bargain if he does what he can, and even if he doesn't, if he just repeats, he's still a great value. What do you think about that, Alex?
Yeah, I've got him for like 22, 5, 245. I really like the plate discipline gains. I said something about it maybe a week ago on Twitter, and I got some pushback about how his contact quality was the worst, in the last 3 years, as evidenced by his absurdly low BABIP and his low home run to fly ball rate. But I'm looking at the positives. I'm seeing improved contact. I'm seeing better discipline. His walk rate is now in the double digits. And I think people often lose sight of the fact that the so-called predictive statistics are also descriptive. And I don't necessarily think that Kepler having a down year in terms of power or in terms of batted ball efficacy means that he got worse. I think it's just kind of one of those things that is a matter of naturally occurring variance. I don't think he's a true talent 10% home run to fly ball rate guy. I don't think he's a true talent 236 BABIP guy. I think both of those things will rebound, like you said. So I think in 2019, we're going to see a culmination of all of his gains from last year with all of his other skills, with the improved fly ball rate, with the better power, and, you know, his BABIP is always going to be terrible, but it's going to be better than 236. So I think he's going to be, yeah, I don't know if I have him for an $11 guy, but he's going to be way better than, you know, the late round pick that he's going as right now in ADP.
Anything to add to that, Ruben?
Yeah, I think his floor is more like what the 2017 season was, when he hit 19 homers and hit 243. His strikeout rate, last year he had 532 at-bats. He only struck out 96 times, as opposed to the year before when he struck out 114 times and 511 at-bats. So that's less. He's showing plate discipline more, like everyone's mentioned. And he is going into his year 26-27 season. That's typically the time when most hitters peak with their power. So I expect his power numbers to go up.
All right, Ruvain, back on another guy, Randall Grichuk. What do you think about him?
Randall Grichuk, I'm actually very high on him. He had a very crazy season last year. He actually injured his knee early in April and was out all of May. And you can see a huge split from after he got injured to from what he did from before. Before the injury, he was batting 106. I mean, it was historically low. Then to the All-Star game, he got it up to 206, and he ended the season batting 245. He had 9 home runs by the All-Star break, but he had 14 home runs after the All-Star break. So you can see there's a huge swing. He's actually doing a lot better. He actually injured the same knee in May that he had surgery on back in 2016, 2017. So that may have been playing into, you know, the way he was feeling, the way he was batting, and then that whole thing.
Right. And I think he is who he is, but the question is playing time. And so far in the last couple of years, he's never really had above 450 at-bats. I look at his lineup, and I don't see anybody in Toronto who's going to supplant him. I think he's going to play and play if healthy. I think he can get up to almost 30 homers. What do you think, Alex?
Yeah. I think he has always been context dependent in terms of his playing time. Back when the Cardinals were actually, you know, pretty good, when they were, you know, legitimate World Series contenders, he was just a platoon piece. He's always going to strike out. That's always going to be a huge part of his game. He's probably never going to bat, you know, better than 250 over the course of a full season, or 260, you know, what have you. But on the Blue Jays, you're right. He has no one blocking him, and if he didn't get injured last year, you know, I think there's a very strong possibility that he not only hits 30 home runs, but he does that in like maybe 540 at bats.
Not at bats, but
plate appearances. And if he gets a full slate, if he plays 150 games, we're talking about 30 plus home runs and batting like 235, 240, which isn't terrible for that kind of power, and especially not at his draft price, which is like 250 overall. So between, like, I saw when you gave me the itinerary, it was like Kepler or Grichuk. I gotta go Grichuk. I mean, the power is, I think, just substantially better. And despite the contact scares, the contact skills misery that he brings, it just absolutely makes up for it.
Right. All right. On to the next bargain. And this next player, per dollar, is the biggest bargain that ATC is showing. It's Kevin Pillar, teammate of Grichuk here. I have him as he's a 19th round ADP going in the NFBC. I have him as an $8 player here. So you only got to pay a dollar, and you're going to make $7 on him. I can't understand why Pillar is this undervalued. Every year he goes 15-15 seemingly. He's not going to give you an absolutely fantastic batting average, but it's something solid. My question to him, though, is where is he going to bat in the lineup? I mean, if he's going to bat leadoff, he's going to have a lot more volume of play. He's going to get those counting stats up. He'll run more. He's going to bat seventh in the order. He's not. But in any case, he has 15-15 ability. He's a very low variance projection guy, because when I look at all the other projections, all the projections are pretty hovering around the same numbers. Pillar is just an absolute bargain for a lot of categories. What do you think, Alex?
Yeah, so I think I agree. He's been one of those guys who is just a consistent performer. It's just that he is boring And like I can't blame people for not liking boring because
boring is fine. Boring is fine.
I'm all about boring. Brett Gardner, he's kind of like a new Brett Gardner in a way. And Brett Gardner's a little older. You know, the wheels are coming off the cart a little bit, but Brett Gardner has always been modest power, modest speed, modest batting average. It's boring, but with volume, it's really valuable. He's one of maybe seven players or whatever to actually turn a profit consistently over the last 5 years, like in every season, because people just keep undervaluing him because he's boring. But he, you know, those steals are valuable. The power is not really eye-popping, but it's enough to kind of supplement that modest speed and modest batting average. Yeah, I've got Pilar on my radar in a bunch of leagues because he's just kind of like free money at the end of the draft.
Well, PR, the thing with him, when people think of PR, they don't think of 15-15. They think of him as flying through the outfield, crashing into walls, and doing that sort of thing. If he can be consistent and get his plate appearances and not miss time like he did in 2016 for his thumb, he missed 6 weeks last year because of a sprain of his shoulder and his collarbone. If he's able to get the playing time, boring is fine when it comes to filling the stat sheet. There's nothing wrong with it, but the thing is, people don't think of him that way. They think of him as a defensive player. They don't think of him as much as an offensive threat.
So the next guy is an interesting guy who really tailed off in the second half, Odubel Herrera of the Phillies. What do you think of him, Alex?
It's funny because I remember, I'm pretty sure this was last year, people were talking about him maybe being an MVP candidate.
Yeah. What a first half.
Do you remember that?
He had 14 homers in the first half, and you know, and I always viewed him as like a steals kind of guy, but yeah, he was all out in the first half last year.
Yeah, well, he finished the year with 0.9 WAR, according to Fangraphs, so he definitely fell off. I didn't ever believe that he was an MVP candidate. I always thought the regression was coming, not to be like that guy, but it's just like sometimes you just have to be intuitive about the guys that you're talking about. He probably had some bad luck with BABIP, but at this point, you know, the power looks good. I think it's going to regress next year. He should hit for more average, but once the speed's gone, I mean, the speed was his actual calling card. You know, hitting for average was nice, but the, you know, the 25 steals that he had in 2016, I think we're still chasing that, and you know, we can't reasonably expect that anymore. I think I have him, if I give me, you know, 2 seconds here, I will tell you that I have him for
bet you it's 8 steals. What do you think?
Let's see. I've got him at 19 homers, 6 steals.
Ooh.
So it's a little more pessimistic. I could see 8 steals. But just it's you know, I regardless, 6 steals, 8 steals, you're not. That's not very optimistic compared to what
you have to see where he's gonna. You have to see where he's gonna bat in the lineup also, because that lineup is a lot deeper now, and he's not going to be the number 3 hitter anymore, so he's going to go down the order a little bit. The question for me is that whether you believe the first half or the second half, his batting average dropped 20 points after the All-Star game. He only had 6 home runs after the All-Star break, which is crazy. It's a matter of, for me, where he bats in the order, because if he bats lower down and there's less pressure and his manager tells him to steal more, then he'll have more value.
So now moving on to a guy who stunk in the first half but was great in the second half, Cole Calhoun. Cole Calhoun had 16 home runs in the second half. Just remember, just a couple of years ago, he had 26 home runs full season. He corrected something in AAA. When he came back, his ground ball rate was down, his line drive rate was up, fly ball rate is up, and his homer to fly ball rate is up. Just things clicked for him.
I don't think he corrected something. I think he got healthy. He had an oblique issue, and he was out for about 3 weeks, and after that he took off.
I think his metrics got better from the past 2 years prior. You know, which is I can't tell you what happened, but his stats are all a lot better. I'm projecting 19 home runs for him. He is a $6 player. He is going in round 24. You know, for a guy who has 20 homers and who has a decent run production level, not a bad pick to get with your 24th rounder. What do you think of Calhoun, Alex?
Yeah, no, I've drafted Calhoun every year for the past 3 years. I actually drafted him last year and held him And I picked him up in a lot of leagues where he was dropped, because he was at the time, you know, early May, mid May, he was the biggest underperformer in terms of expected weighted on base average and actual performance. So, you know, even despite the oblique injury, he was still critically underperforming his actual performance level, and he finished the season as the biggest underperformer as well. So it just points to a ton of bad luck. Yeah, him getting over the oblique issue is nice. The power looks like it's there. It's just a matter of getting that BABIP up. And, you know, StatCast is telling us that it can be almost entirely chalked up to bad luck. The contact skills caved a little bit, but I think that's also something that, you know, that could be maybe attributed to injury, to, you know, attributed to just kind of having, you know, a bit of a cold spell there at the beginning. I'm willing to kind of write off 2018 and kind of, and expect more of his maybe 2016, 2017 performance, which for me on paper it says 19 homers, 251 batting average, which is like basically right in between his 2016, 2017 seasons, which are immense profit over his current ADP.
Right. I call him a safe profit guy. If you're in the 24th round and Calhoun is still available, it's a safe profit there. A lot of people will take their 24th round for a very high upside guy, some rookie flash. But, you know, you can make a nice bargain with Calhoun. Remember, just a couple years ago, he was a $13, $14 player every single year. Doesn't take much for him to get back to that level. He's 31, but, you know, old plate skills, he can still hit the homer. All right, finishing off here, Jesse Winker, talking about rookies. Jesse Winker, the ATC projections have him as a $12 player who's going for five. I think one reason why, it's not that his valuation, it's that people don't see a clear path to the lineup. In the Cincinnati outfield, there's Kemp, there's Puig, there's Schebler. So people don't really see a spot for him to play, and maybe that's depressing his ADP and, you know, maybe some injury history to him. I think that this guy has a 290 batting average floor. I think that Winker can hit you the 15, 16 homers. I would not be fooled by the current seeming lack of playing time possibility. I think Winker is a great guy to get value for, and he'll finish with a lot of counting stats, a lot of plate appearances. He'll get you that run production. Ruvane, what do you think of Jesse Winker?
I think a lot of it is people remembering that he was out for an extended period of time. He had a right shoulder subluxation, which is similar to dislocation, which, you know, it hampered him for a good portion of the season. The main thing, like you mentioned, is the playing time, because he's got, like you mentioned, Kemp, Schebler, Puig, and now recently they mentioned Nixon Zell will take some time in the outfield also. So that's someone else that he's going to go behind. So he's got to hop ahead of somebody. But when you have those guys ahead of you, there is a risk of injury with all those players. And Schebler has been underperforming the last couple of years. So there is, I do see a space where he'll get the playing time. The question is, how soon it's going to be and how soon in the season he's going to get that.
Alex?
Yeah, it's a little rough. I do really like Winker a lot. I think he, especially if the shoulder issue is resolved, it sounded like he was saying that it had been affecting his power. And that's, you know, the one facet of his game that hasn't really shown up in spades yet. The plate discipline is already elite. He's going to be the heir apparent to Joey Votto's OBP throne when he eventually retires or leaves Cincinnati. And he's going to hit for incredibly high average. The only thing is that we'd like that to not be an empty average. 15 home runs is nice, but if he can really tap into, hitting home runs on 15% of fly balls, he could be a 20 homer, 300 guy, which makes him, you know, a top 50 bat. Being risk averse myself, I probably won't have a ton of Winker just because of that non-guaranteed playing time. But I'm not going to fault anyone for chasing it. And if you construct your roster in a way that kind of begets drafting Winker, that you have enough playing time, floor for the, you know, so to speak, then Winker fits your fits your construction, then go for it. Absolutely.
Yeah. But batting average is tough to find late, so it's just somebody to keep in mind late if you need it. Very quickly, last two guys here. The Cleveland outfield. I don't even know who's in the Cleveland outfield. Martin, Naquin, Luplo. We have two guys who can possibly provide you with some speed late, Greg Allen and Leonis Martin. Do you like any of those guys, Alex?
Yeah, I mean, conditionally, yeah. Leonis Martin, not as much. I always had thought of him as a nice speed option late, even if he didn't play a full season, which he never does. But the last couple of years, it has been a little tepid on that front. I don't expect, maybe more than 20 steals over the course of a full season, which isn't bad. But Greg Allen gave us 20 steals in less than 300 plate appearances last year. Yeah. And the prospect that he, the prospect of him not even being like a pinch hitter or a part-time guy, but maybe having the bulk of a role in an outfield spot is like actually insane to think about the kind of value he could provide. And we're talking about Malik Smith, and like the line of DeShields and
Dyson.
Yeah, Jarrod Dyson, whoever else is, whoever else we perceive as like the quintessential speed threats, Greg Allen is like definitely the dark horse of that group and might have the best playing time opportunity, except for maybe Malik's, but has a really good opportunity for a team that, for whatever reason, is punting out of the number one spot of the AL Central. Greg Allen is super interesting to me, going like 330th or whatever right now in NFBC. So he's firmly like, 22nd round.
To throw some intriguing numbers out there, in 2015 in single A, he had 57 stolen bases. In 2016 in single A and double A, he had a total of 78 stolen bases.
Like
so
Billy
that's Billy Hamilton with a 245 average, which is,
Better than Billy Hamilton.
You can live with that.
Right. And Ruben, because of injury, Leonis Martin had some kind of infection last year. What was that story?
He had an infection in his leg. He's completely healthy now. There's no issue. He's already said he's going to spring training. No restrictions, and he's good to go.
All right. Quick predictions from you guys. I'll let you guys both pick. Where does Bryce Harper and Manny Machado actually sign? Alex?
I've really tried not to care. I think Machado might end up in Philly. Harper, I don't know. I'm being very easily swayed by what I've read, which is Giants. I am willing to say that he ends up, yeah, sure, whatever, on the Giants. I just don't see that. For some reason, I don't see that happening. But I'll just go with the okay. crowd here.
Well, Harper said that he doesn't want to take a short term deal, and that's only what San Francisco is offering him. So I actually think that Harper is going to end up back in Washington because they already offered it to him. They have that money allotted to him. So I think he's going to end up there. And unfortunately, because I'm a Met fan, I think Machado's going to end up in Philly, and I think the National League East is going to be a bloodbath.
Well. I think that if he signs a pillow deal, if it's going to be a short-term 2-3 year deal with a huge AAV and opt-outs after every year and buyout at the end, it's going to be with the Giants. I think that's clear. I don't think the Giants want to offer him long-term. I think he wants a long-term. So if those can't meet, I think he will go to. I think Washington might be the best spot for him, as you said, Ruben. The money is there for him, and he knows the landscape. And I think they're the ones who originally offered the $300 million. But I personally think he's going to end up in San Fran. I think he's going to get this huge $45, $50 million AAV deal there. Machado, I have no clue. I'm going to say the Yankees just to be different from you guys. I think that he's in a win now mode. The Yankees really don't have a shortstop. I mean, Tulowitzki doesn't count because he might not even play that much. I can see him getting injured in 10 seconds. All right. Ruben, we're now going to go to the outfielder injury update for some key outfielders low down.
Okay, well, we mentioned Jesse Winker earlier. He has finished his rehab for his shoulder, and he's going to be ready for spring training. Eloy Jimenez actually strained his quad in Dominican Bowl over the winter. They shut him down during the winter. He is fully healthy, and he's going to start the season in the minors. Jared Dyson had surgery for his groin in September. He's expected to be ready for spring training.
Groin region.
I don't want to make it sound anything worse or whatever he wanted. I don't know what you're implying. Mark Trumbo had knee surgery September 2018 and is expected to be ready for opening day, according to the general manager. He actually began batting practice in mid-January. Juan Lagares had toe surgery at the end of May 2018. He played in winter ball and he seems good to go. Jacoby Ellsbury, he had his surgery on his hip in August 2018, and Brian Cashman did say that he's due to be healthy in spring training, but where will he play? And lastly, Alex Dickerson had Tommy John surgery in March 2018, but he is expected to be ready for spring training.
All right there. Well, let's wrap up the show here. A very, very special thank you to Alex Chamberlain for joining us. It's our first guest on the Beat the Shift edition, and really thank you so much for being here, Alex.
Oh, thank you guys for having me. It was a lot of fun.
No, great discussion. I really appreciate it. Alex, tell everybody where you can be reached.
Sure, yeah. I'm on Rotographs with Ariel. I'm going to be on CBS Sportsline. That's probably going to start in like March or April. You can find me on Twitter. I have the worst Twitter handle in the world. It's Dolph Haldhagen, DolphHaldhagen. So I'm on Twitter. And that's it. I'm going to be in Tout Wars this year. You're going to be in Tout Wars this year. So it's going to be a party.
Ruvane?
You can follow me on Twitter at MLB Injury Guru, and I continually update my injuries both on Twitter and in the Fantasy Benefit guide, which Justin Mason puts out.
Yeah, for you guys who don't follow Ruvane yet, if you're looking for a one-stop shop of when a guy is coming back, what's his prognosis, Ruvane is the guy. Really accurate information, and it's coming from he gathers news and he puts his medical spin on it. For me, Ariel Cohen, you can reach me. I have the best Twitter handle, which is our running joke on this show here, ATCNY. That's just five letters right there.
You mean shortest, not best. Shortest.
It is the shortest, the best. Well, if you can remember it, then it is the best. And you can find my work on Rotographs and CBS Sportsline already. I've got my first article up there, which is how to translate projections into auction dollars, which is something that everyone, if you don't do it yourself, you should think about doing it or at least learn what goes into that. All right, that concludes this episode, this Beat the Shift episode of the Great Fantasy Baseball Invitational. Hopefully Justin will be back on our pod next week. And as we say here, have a great baseball season. First place in my league, got a blockbuster on my way, and a pickup on my sleeve. They call my team insane, say I'm the one to beat. So you better bring your A game and start playing, cause every single week another win for me. Yo, commissioner, you can just pay me now. City win first place, then take a bow. Finish on top, I'ma set the standard. Don't believe me, you could check the standings. When I draft, I make smart selections. Got more sleepers than a narcoleptic. Meet your match, kid, my lineup's nasty. It's far-fetched, thinking you might catch me. No surprise, I'm taking home the prize. Only time I rest is a playoff bye. Make amazing finds off the waiver wire. All day and night, better stay retired. See me in first, all proud and cozy. Bro, please, I can't even count my trophies. Bragging, even with my bats are slumping, I'ma pack a punch, that track a junkie. Only one they don't wanna pay, first place in my league, got a blockbuster on my way.